You also have been hearing about all kinds of banking problems through the courtesy of the Rockefeller propaganda machine, which wants you to be aware of them in order to help undermine your confidence. But there are some aspects to the banking picture right now that are far more major than anything you're being told about through the Rockefeller media, which involve real mistakes and difficulties faced by the Rockefellers themselves. I'm not referring here to those nerve-jangling front-page stories about Chase Manhattan and First National City Bank, which were planted by the Rockefellers themselves for reasons I have explained in another monthly audio letter recently. I refer instead to the situation which recently sent Henry Kissinger packing off to Latin America. If you did not quite understand what our Secretary of State was doing there, don't feel bad. You weren't supposed to. Kissinger was sent there as a bill collector for David Rockefeller, who has suddenly discovered that his banking interests, including the United States Export-Import Bank, have about $25 billion in outstanding credits in Latin America that are very shaky indeed. The four brothers have been so busy prying into everyone else's business that they have not been minding their own store. As presently scheduled, Kissinger's trip is to be followed up in May by a trip by Secretary of Treasury William Simon before he resigns to continue working for David Rockefeller in some other slot, perhaps at Chase Manhattan Bank. Simon can hardly wait to get out of the Treasury hot seat he has been ever since December 1975, when we caught him in an outright lie, in writing no less, about the existence of the central core vault of the bullion depository at Fort Knox. The Rockefeller banking picture is in additional hot water because, for various reasons, Arab OPEC interests began pulling out their funds in this country starting early this month, March 1976. Around $20 billion in Arab money may be withdrawn, but because of our dishonest fractional reserve banking system, which normally works to the advantage of the Rockefellers, the Arab withdrawals could translate into a drop of over $100 billion in total bank deposits. That is enough to trigger some serious economic repercussions prematurely, before the Rockefellers are ready to mesh them into their complex program, and that is why the Federal Reserve Board surprised a lot of people last week by starting to pump funds into the banking system. And so it goes. As the four Rockefeller brothers continue to husband their own cash resources to take advantage of cheap bargains while walking the tightrope to dictatorship. Meanwhile, what is Congress doing for us? Last month, there was a brief ray of hope when Congressman Wright Patman uncovered a hornet's nest by exposing a network of interlocks between the Federal Reserve System and the powerful Business Roundtable, which helped defeat Patman's latest attempt to audit the Federal Reserve. This could have spelled real trouble for the Rockefeller brothers because both the Business Roundtable and the Federal Reserve are 24-karat Rockefeller. But fortunately for the Rockefellers, Patman just happened to become seriously ill before he could carry the matter any further, and he passed away early this month. And with him died any hope that the matter will be pursued an inch further. Now we are left with the likes of Congressman Otis Pike, who made the terrible mistake of pulling his punches at the Rockefeller CIA. Had he followed through on the Fort Knox matter after our discussions with him last September, he would be in the driver's seat now. But as it is, the CIA has now vowed to finish Otis Pike politically, and you can be sure they will try. And then there's Congressman John Conlon, who several months ago hurled a challenge at his constituents who dared to press him for action about Fort Knox, saying that if they had evidence of any wrongdoing, he would put them in contact with the appropriate authorities to carry out an investigation. But when my colleague Ed Durrell, who, with myself, does have access to such evidence, took up the Conlon challenge forwarded to us by those constituents, Congressman Conlon apparently forgot all about his pledge to help establish the proper contacts to get a true investigation rolling. In my monthly audio letter number 8 for January 1976, I read Ed Durell's open letter to Congressman Conlon of January 7, 1976, in its entirety. Here now is Congressman Conlon's reply in its entirety, dated February 26, 1976, 7 weeks after the date of Mr. Ed Durell's certified letter. And I quote, "Dear Mr. Durell, following up receipt of your certified open letter to me, I wanted to bring you up to date on my actions. I have written to the Chairman of the House Banking, Currency, and Housing Committee, Henry Royce, Chairman of the House Domestic Monetary Policy Committee, Wright Patman, and Chairman of the House Government Operations Committee, Jack Brooks. I will let you know when I receive their replies. Also, I am enclosing a copy of my letter to Secretary Simon, in which I request a complete inventory of United States gold holdings. I have asked him to let me know what action he plans to take in this regard. It is unfortunate that there are not more congressmen and people in the administration and the Attorney General's office who are more interested in clarifying this matter. I am just one sincere congressman, Mr. Durell, and much as you and I would like to think, I cannot order official Washington to do yours and my bidding. If I could, Henry Kissinger and others would have been replaced a long time ago. Cordially, John B. Conlon, Member of Congress." And that, my friends, is apparently that, as far as John Conlon is concerned. He continually professes to be concerned about Fort Knox. Yet here is not even the token of an attempt to open any doors for a good investigation into the matter. No speeches on the House floor, no press conference, no real follow-up to Mr. Durell's letter in any way. Just a very intimate letter to William Simon, Treasury Secretary, who himself is party to the cover-up. Why doesn't John Conlon tell us what Bill Simon told him on the night of January the 5th, 1975, in private? Conlon did not even bother to dignify his reply to Mr. Durell with a personal signature as he did to Simon. Instead, a signature duplicating machine was used. Yes, this is the same Congressman, John B. Conlon, you may have read about recently, leading the White House prayer breakfast. This is the same Congressman, John B. Conlon, whose name you will see as the author of a religious tract exhorting citizens to get involved. And this is the same Congressman, John B. Conlon, who, as the member of the House Banking Committee, has accepted money for his re-election campaign from the banking lobby. Apparently, this is Congressman Conlon's concept of what it means to be a representative. And in one respect at least, he is completely representative. He may not represent you or me, but he does accurately represent what the United States Congress stands for today. His behavior is a perfect example of why our republic is so close to extinction today. This being the case, I for myself shall now leave him alone with his own conscience. Topic number 3. Recently, a CBS reporter asked Nelson Rockefeller if he would still like to be president. He shot back, "What do you think I've been doing for the past 16 years?" He has actually been at it longer than that, my friends, and now the prize he has kept his eyes focused on for so long is almost within his grasp. But because of the foreshortened time schedule now remaining to him, we are now entering a period of tactical maneuvering that is likely to be bewildering in its dodges and reversals of apparent direction. This final phase has already begun, in fact, since I spoke to you just last month, and already one major tactical shift has occurred. When I recorded monthly audio letter number 9 last month, my information was that the plan was to make President Ford stumble in the primaries and force him to bow out before the onslaught of Ronald Reagan. The goal of forcing Ford out soon has not changed one iota, but the tactics to achieve this have been revised drastically for reasons directly related to former President Nixon's trip to China late last month. In other words, to understand our domestic politics now, you also must look at the international scene. Last November 1975, you will recall that Ford went to China. While he was there, the Chinese leaders confronted him about the huge Asian war that is now brewing, and I am told that Ford turned pale and wobbly as he learned about these things for the first time from the Red Chinese. What they told him about the grand strategy for the war was the same thing I told you that same month in monthly audio letter number 6, about the Middle East being the opening gun, about the role of the Helsinki Accord last summer, about the strategy of the encirclement of Red China by means of the Rockefeller Soviet conquest of Southeast Asia. Even now, as I say these words, the domino theory is being dusted off and revived to explain the plan toppling soon of the last important domino in that area, Thailand. The 5,000 or so Americans there include a fifth column contingent that is to pave the way for Thailand to be handed over to the Communists under Soviet control. When Ford returned, he began working as closely as possible with Richard Nixon, and now the team of Nixon, Ford, and Connally are engaged in a power struggle against Nelson Rockefeller and his lackeys, Ronald Reagan and Hubert Humphrey. As I have revealed in previous audio letters, Richard Nixon is on the phone just about daily to tell Ford to hang in there, and so far Ford has done so. Nixon's trip to China last month was not at the request of the State Department, but instead at the request of President Ford himself. Nixon's trip to China was an errand of peace in that he is trying to maintain a link between the United States and China to offset as much as possible the hard alliance between the Rockefeller brothers and the Soviets. Nixon knows very well that Nelson Rockefeller is still out to get him if possible. That is why Nixon was unwilling to make the trip on anything but a Red Chinese airplane sent here for that purpose. Faced with this Nixon-Ford-Connally axis, Nelson Rockefeller decided several weeks ago on tactics designed to give his opponents a political judo throw, that is, to send them sprawling by using their own strength and momentum. First, he reprogrammed his kept media to help instead of hurt Ford in the primaries, thus lulling Ford into false confidence over his own seemingly growing strength. Reagan is to be beaten for now, but not so badly that he would look bad later on when Rockefeller is ready to tap him as his vice president. To make sure Reagan gets the message not to drop out of the campaign, Rockefeller told Reagan to remain a candidate against Ford, quote, as long as the money holds out, unquote. And just to make sure, Rockefeller's comments in this vein were echoed by his lackey Barry Goldwater, who ironically ran for president 12 years ago on the slogan, a choice, not an echo. To further build up the self-confidence of the Nixon-Ford-Connally axis, and also to fool the Red Chinese, if possible, into thinking that a favorable shift in American policy is being achieved, other things are also being done. For example, Ford has now officially deleted the word détente from his vocabulary, and some harsher-than-usual words have been permitted to emanate from Washington in the direction of the Soviet Union. After all, words are cheap for domestic consumption. Meanwhile, the final touches are being put on the preparations for war, and at the same time, several options are being prepared to enable Ford to be suddenly and surprisingly cut down and swept out of office. One option would involve the exposure of a fast-breaking financial scandal whose possible speed can be guessed at by the devastating experience undergone by Vice President Spiro Agnew in 1973. Other options, however, are also being prepared because Nelson Rockefeller intends to take no chances at this late date. When war, shortages, and economic catastrophe arrive, Nelson Rockefeller fully intends to be the beneficiary of it all, easing himself into power as our president and then dictator. The eagerness with which he awaits this turn of events stands in stark contrast to the horrified reaction of other world figures who have learned recently about the imminent war. For example, early last December, when I was in Europe and England, I gave a copy of my monthly audio letter number 6 detailing the war plans to a person who played it for Prime Minister Harold Wilson. The result? On December 15, he secretly gave the Queen 3 months' notice of the fact that he intended to resign. And 3 days ago, he stunned England and the world by doing just that. It is sad indeed that Richard Nixon, who is now doing what he can to fight for peace, was nonetheless used successfully by the Rockefellers to do our nation grave injury in many areas while he was president, just as they have done with every president since Woodrow Wilson. And it is ironic that Nelson Rockefeller's plan to declare an iron-fisted national emergency soon will make use of a tool left to him by none other than his present bitter enemy, Richard Nixon. I refer to Presidential Executive Order 11490 dealing with emergency preparedness signed by Nixon October 28, 1969. It is 33 pages long. It spells out vast powers and functions to be exercised by 28 federal departments and agencies in the event of a declared national emergency. Under the terms of this executive order, these emergency powers can be activated either by Congress or by proclamation of the President. To the unwary, the idea may come across that this executive order would only be used in time of war due to the frequent reference to, quote, emergency, including an attack on the United States, unquote. But note well that war is actually just given as an example of an emergency situation. At the outset, it is stated to be applicable, quote, in any national emergency type situation that might conceivably confront the nation, unquote. No other criteria are given to govern the declaration of such an emergency. Therefore, all that Nelson Rockefeller or another president or Congress needs to do is to conceive of a situation as fitting their concept of an emergency, and Executive Order 11490 can be invoked. It is to be done in the, quote, national interest, unquote, but that is never defined. But one section makes the purpose of the order explicitly clear in the words, and I quote, assuring the continuity of the federal government in any national emergency type situation that might confront the nation, unquote. The federal government is the focus here, not the nation, not the people, not the republic, but the federal government. In other words, it is designed for the benefit of our rulers, just as in the secret new Rockefeller Constitution. Once invoked, Executive Order 11490 authorizes unconstitutional and so illegal powers to be wielded by the federal government under the guise of bland-sounding words like emergency management and operation. The federal government is authorized to completely take over business and industry or any parts thereof without compensation. Border closing and control, censorship, and the registration and continual monitoring of all citizens and their movements are also provided for under Executive Order 11490 with the quasi-private United States Postal Service playing an important role in this, as I revealed in my audio letter last month. Full powers over transportation and communication are also granted, along with all forms of energy right down to flashlight batteries. Even your pocket radio would be included because of the authority given to control any device capable of emitting electromagnetic radiation, which your radio and TV do in small amounts. The clandestine federal police structure now in place in the United States, which I warned you about last month, would also be activated under this executive order. So would special emergency measures for custody and protection of prisoners. These are worded in such a way as to make their true meaning anything but obvious unless the phrase, quote, mass feeding and housing, unquote, is noticed. This refers, my friends, to the hush-hush concentration camps, which are now in a condition of operational readiness in remote areas all around the United States. Executive Order 11490 even places at the disposal of the federal government that most cruel and most powerful of all tools for mass political control, hunger. Various provisions for stockpiling of survival items, food and water included, are worded in such a way that they could be initiated after the declaration of emergency rather than being prepared ahead of time to meet that emergency. Thus, the federal government could artificially create terrible shortages at will under the guise of stockpiling. And if you think such a thing is too far-fetched, just remember back to the early days of World War II if you are old enough. Do you recall, for example, that you were required after war broke out to turn in any extra tires you may have had and thereafter had a hard time getting any new ones? The excuse given was the rubber had to be stockpiled and recycled into the war effort, but that was an outright lie. I have been given eyewitness accounts by people who saw these tires piled up, slashed, and burned after they were turned in. And the Congressional Record in 1942 contains a great deal of material brought out by then-Senator Harry Truman showing that there was a deliberate larger plan to deny many critical war materials both to the American public and our military forces in the early days of the war. And guess who was implicated in all of this? You're right, the Rockefeller Standard Oil interests. Given all of this, the possibility must not be overlooked that there will be no election next November if Nelson Rockefeller and his brothers successfully orchestrate the various elements of their do-or-die plan of conquest. Executive Order 11490, in the hands of a man who has shown himself to be unhampered by scruples or conscience, could be used in effect to suspend our present United States Constitution, and next November we may be given no choice at the polls except a yes or no vote in a national referendum on the proposed new Rockefeller Constitution. Voting on fixable voting machines under the watchful eyes of the federal police, the outcome, if that is permitted to happen, would be in very little doubt. Just as Cuba did last month, on February 15, 1976, we could be counted upon to ratify a new Constitution to replace our suspended older one. These things do not have to happen, my friends. The Rockefeller brothers can be made to trip by the spreading awareness of and reaction to the truth, the absolute truth. But in case there are any doubting Thomases listening to my voice, I say to you now, if you sit back and watch as all this comes to pass before your very eyes, do not look back a year from now and say, why weren't we warned? Because, my dear friend, you were. Until next month, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.